Final hour, Robbie and Rex Road here on 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rex Road. Michelle Knezovic here with you on this Tuesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. And we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. And welcome in our good friend Kyle Tucker from The Athletic. Kyle, what's going on? How are we doing?
Oh, not much. Nothing to talk about with Kentucky sports. No. You know, it's August. What could there possibly be that would come up and be a big, you know, national story or anything?
Yeah, only media-created issues, yeah. That's what I say.
You just came back from a nice, relaxing trip to the Bahamas, last I checked.
Yeah, exactly. Only thing I did was just make up a story out of thin air for no reason to piss off everybody involved.
Oh, Kyle, we've had so much fun with this story so far this week. I'm really interested to get your thoughts on it. So let's just start simply there. What do you make of all that's transpired, the war of words between John Calipari and Mark Stoops, now the athletic director getting involved? What do you make of this situation that has sprung up over the past few days?
I think everybody looks bad because, frankly, they haven't won jack, either one of them. The Rifles won three national titles at Kentucky, and volleyball has won a national title. So I don't know what either one of these guys, is talking about. It's cheerleaders have won like 21 national championships. I think the whole thing was unnecessarily turned into a national story, and it feels to me like Stoops, to a degree, but especially Mitch Barnhart, the athletic director, really, really made this what it is. I mean, like Cal should not have said what he said. And to his credit, and this is like Cal's not a big I'm wrong guy. He has a running joke that I've heard him tell 100 times whenever he talks about being wrong. He's like, I was wrong once. You know, it was 1978 or whatever. That's just like he says that all the time. He's not a big I'm wrong guy, but he immediately knew that he had said the wrong thing when he lumped in. I mean, saying Kentucky's a basketball school, not an untrue fact, not a controversial statement. Like that is what it is, right? Like it's a basketball school. There's just no one would argue. When there's all this semantics about, well, football drives the train and makes all the money. I get that. We're talking about, like, what are you known for? What is your prestige program? It's basketball. What has improved the university's brand? What brings enrollment to the school? It is basketball. Has been, will be. It is. Now, has football come up? Yes. Does football drive the train financially? Yes. I would also argue when you go into the raw data there, like most basketball programs are a financial drain on the university. Kentucky's runs a profit, and that's it's not just raw football makes more money than basketball, even at Kentucky. Kentucky's like the only place in America where the basketball program is not only not a drain, it adds to the pot. Anyway, it's a basketball school. It's a really good, a lot of other things school. It's not a super controversial statement, but Cal even himself immediately realized that saying the thing about, you know, Alabama and Georgia are football schools, and, you know, and the whole no disrespect to our program, I hope they win 10 games, but we're a basketball school. He understood that he screwed up by bringing in two schools in the league that they compete against and they're trying to recruit against. And he said that behind the scenes. He has since sort of essentially said that publicly. But where this all went off the rails was that Stoops immediately reacted in a really sort of public and clapbacky way. He quote tweeted my story that I tweeted out, and then retweeted some people saying that it was you know, insulting, and then football players hop on and start taking shots at the basketball program. That made it a story, a pretty big story. But what made it like this ongoing huge national story is then on Saturday, Stoops comes out and takes some pretty obvious shots in a press conference. And then Barnhart, who you thought was going to come out and play peacemaker, talks for 45 minutes and essentially throws Cal under the bus, makes some pretty major, like, pointed comments that were directed at Calipari about being grateful and not being entitled and saying he's not going to get his practice facility, and getting all wound up. And then of course this the utterly stupid you know, this is the media's fault, or just out there making up stories. Like, no, that's not what happened. First of all, it was my story that started all this, and I can tell you, Cal wanted to talk about the facility. He knew what he was doing. He misspoke, but he wasn't misquoted. He made a mistake, but he wasn't. I wasn't misrepresented. We have talked since then. I know that it wasn't. He doesn't think I did him wrong. He just thinks he messed up, and it caused a huge controversy. And so, I really thought the biggest thing to me was just like, why keep letting this be a story? Especially if you're Mitch Barnhart, why in the world? What good could possibly come from inflaming it further? And so that's the part I don't understand. I think it's been poorly handled from that point of view. The other thing is behind the scenes, like Cal wanted to immediately apologize. He wanted to put out a tweet. He crafted a statement. He thought about going on SEC Network during one of those games that was being broadcast and apologizing. He eventually finally did just say, screw it, I'm going to say something. And he said, I said the wrong thing. But in that time, he was being told by the athletic department, let it die. Don't say anything else. He was, all his attempts to publicly squash it were shut down. Stoops has not returned his phone calls or other efforts to talk to him. And then they come out Saturday and nuke him in these two press conferences. I mean, it was a bizarre, it has been a truly bizarre way for everybody to handle it, and it never had to be as big of a story as it has become.
Let it die, Cal, so we can have a chance to just completely rip you during a press conference in a couple days.
Yeah.
I have to think, I just have to come away from this thinking that Mitch and Mark don't like John very much. I can't get around that. Like, if they did, they would not have done a lot of these things, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I don't know how you could draw another conclusion. And that's the big takeaway for me too, is that Mitch Barnhart apparently has so little relationship, such underdeveloped relationships with his two biggest head coaches, that he was unable to get them quietly behind doors to speak and squash it, and also just have any level of authority over them to say, shut up. I mean, like, let's also be clear about who's boss. And it ain't Mitch Barnhart as the boss of anybody. At least those two guys don't think so. And that's pretty telling as well. And now let me say, Mitch Barnhart is a very good athletic director, a very good athletic director. He is considered one of the best, if not the best, in the country. He has completely overhauled their facilities in just about every sport. I mean, football was Vanderbilt. From a facilities perspective, Kentucky football was Vanderbilt. They had embarrassingly bad facilities, and now they're up to snuff. They are SEC level facilities. The staff is all paid at the highest level. Stoops is a top 10 paid coach. And then they're good at all these other things. I mentioned rifle and volleyball, and baseball and softball have beautiful new facilities, and softball's been to a World Series, and tons of women's sports have risen under Stoops. Track and field, they're a powerhouse under Mitch, sorry. They're a powerhouse in track and field. They're churning out like world champions now. Mitch is good. He is a good athletic director. He has been good for the department. He is widely respected. He's been the chair of the NCAA tournament committee. He's been, I believe, the chair of the rules oversight committee. I mean, it would not shock me if he was on the short list of people to replace Mark Emmert as the president of the NCAA. He is well respected, but he clearly, one, he's not good at PR. He doesn't ever talk. We never see him. He hides. He talks one time in 6 months and drops a nuclear bomb on everything. It really is crazy to me that he was not in a position to squash this because he doesn't have relationships with those guys. And yeah, more to the point, it seems to me the larger issue is that Calipari and Mitch are were in a cold war, and now they're in a war with each other, because there's things Cal feels like he wants that he's not getting. This practice facility started all this. He wants the gold standard of practice facilities. You can debate whether that should be a thing after 15 years after they built the last one, but get the thing he wants, and they can't get on the same page. And now Cal is going public to get what he wants. I'm sure Mitch wants, you know, an NCAA tournament win, which they haven't had in 3 years. You know, and so they seem to be at odds with each other, and that's, you know, that's part of this, now part of this story too. Again, never had to be, it's never really had to be a very big story. To start, if Mark Stoops doesn't reply publicly, if he just says something to Cal privately, it's probably not a story at all. Like, Kentucky fans maybe talk about it, but, oh, Cal says that. But there's no reaction, so there's no perceived fight. Cal maybe says, hey, I've said that wrong, and it's over. I mean, without a doubt, Cal said the wrong thing, no doubt, to start it. Mark Stoops made it a story, and then Stoops and Barnhart made it a huge story on Saturday.
Talking to Kyle Tucker of The Athletic, who I thought was just going down to the Bahamas, chill out, pina colada, a little bit of hoops, and actually turns out some amazing stuff, including on Oscar Tshiebwe. The NIL story on him was pretty amazing because he had to make all his money down there, and Calipari says, yeah, go do the commercials all day. That's a fascinating story, but also then comes in with this this bombshell that people are still talking about with Kentucky. So last thing, Kyle, is there a tenure on either side here that is altered or cut short because of this situation?
I think it's possible. You know, I mean, I can't imagine that Calipari isn't absolutely stewing behind the scenes. And now he has continued to not respond. I mean, other than saying I messed up, like he's on Twitter now with a short TV interview, two places. Now, he has publicly said, basically, my bad, I messed up. But he has not gotten back in the back and forth. He didn't want to talk anymore. He didn't want to do any more appearances down there with the media because he didn't want to be asked and have to, you know, either no comment it or get back into the war words. He doesn't want that. He wants it to be over. But I know he's got to be furious about some of the stuff that kind of got lobbed at him in return, kind of like, what is going on here? Like, you're really going to take shots at me? You know, Cal's not been in that position before. He's always been the unquestioned BMOC wherever he's been. And so I think this was probably a little jarring to him. So it's possible, I guess, that somebody, I don't like the idea like Stoops is just going to hop off and leave. Like, he's got it really good at Kentucky. Like, as good, Andy Staples at The Athletic has argued the best job in football because relative to expectations, you know, what is success, what you're making. I mean, again, top 10 paid coach in the country. Don't think they've ever finished in the top 10 in any rankings. So he's being paid above his level, really. Although, you know, yes, Kentucky is way overachieving under him. Again, you wouldn't say that if it was not a basketball school, right? Like, he's got a great job because expectations are relatively relatively modest at what constitutes success at Kentucky. Calipari faces the exact opposite, like title or bust. Anyway, the end of the day, for both men, you know, unless they get fired, and I don't see that happening either, because the money, the long-winded point I'm making is, the money, the end. It's too much money to pay them to fire them. It's too much money for either of them to walk away. And so I think they'll both stay until they get tired of being really, really rich.
Kyle Tucker from The Athletic, our guest here on Robbie and Rexer. Kyle, great job down there at Bahamas. I think they ought to send you back. Appreciate you taking time to join us.
I agree. Thank you.
Absolutely. Kyle Tucker, our guest here on Robbie and Rexro. We'll continue this conversation coming up next, including the question that Joe Rexrode wants to get to, which I'm looking forward to. What school, if you could pick from your school with a coach to keep, who would it be? Football, men's basketball, women's basketball? Take it any way you want to take it. We'll get to that coming up next. This is Robbie and Rexrode, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Tennessee Byway. One arm on the wheel. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on 102.5, 106.3 The Game, streaming live on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. Our video streaming brought to you by the Law Offices of Amanda Gentry. We are live from the Hillside Medical Game Studio on this Tuesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks to Kyle Tucker for joining us in the last segment. So, Joe, let's throw this out there. With the Kentucky drama going on, and boy, is it juicy. I enjoyed every second of that interview with Kyle Tucker.
Thank you, Kyle Tucker, for so many things.
Yeah, real good stuff out there from Kyle Tucker.
Kind of stressed me out a little.
I thought it was awesome.
Me too.
I do. In all seriousness,
I'm here for all
like
of this.
The one thing that I said this yesterday. The one thing that I absolutely take away from this is I don't think Mark Stoops and John Calipari like each other very much at all. Or at least Stoops to Calipari.
Exactly. I mean, the third base comment is like, whew, man. And not to mention the 4 postseason wins in a row. I mean, that's – man. That's the thing that surprises me most about
all I've never
all
seen
this.
Anything like this. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's like that Stoops just went unhinged on this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like, damn. Yeah, he must really – not like Cal.
I can't imagine why somebody wouldn't like Cal.
I can't
I
either.
Enjoy him. Yeah. I enjoy Cal. That's just me. But
we all do. We're big fans.
Yeah, big fans. So with that in mind, let's throw this question out there. Take your school, whoever it is, Tennessee, Vanderbilt, whoever. You could pick one coach to stay and one coach that has to leave. What are you picking?
So if you go – yeah, so like
let's say so it's Tennessee. Let's go Tennessee.
Let's say Tennessee. So if you did Tennessee Vanderbilt, like to me, like I mean, like Kyle laid out, there's other great programs, but I mean, let's stick to like the top programs. So like if you took Tennessee and Vanderbilt, I think almost every fan would probably just go baseball, right? So let's eliminate those guys.
Right.
I mean, Vitale. I think Vanderbilt, no doubt. But I think with Tennessee, right? Would you
agree? You have to right now.
Like yeah. Tony V, they're about to be preseason number one.
Yeah.
So let's say football, men's and women's basketball.
Okay.
You're a Tennessee fan. So of those three, who absolutely has to continue?
God, this is hard.
It's kind of hard for Tennessee.
Yeah, it is hard. Yeah.
I think I'm going Rick Barnes.
You're keeping Rick Barnes?
I think I am.
Wow.
Continue with those no postseason wins.
Oh, hey. Man.
Ooh, as I recall,
dominating Kentucky. I guess.
As I recall, yet again, they won the SEC tournament this year, and one more game in the tournament
for the first time ever. So, congrats!
They did. They did. It's true. So the interesting thing about picking Barnes is, you know, like I mean, how many more years does he have? I don't know. I mean, it's not like he can't coach for many more years. But
I like Heupel. I like what he's done thus far.
Yeah,
I like Kelly Harper. I like what she's doing.
I'm really intrigued by that team this year with Kelly Harper, Justine Passat coming in, and Rekia Jackson transferring in. Like, Kelly Harper has exceeded my expectations for her, period. Rick Barnes has way exceeded expectations. Think about when he came over from Texas. Like, that was like, oh, great, go pick up one more paycheck, old man.
Well, that's the thing.
That's
like,
not what's happening.
Everybody's all over Rick Barnes, and I understand it. We talk about the postseason stuff all the time. I mean, his team did win a championship this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. they were a championship winning team.
Right. And he's got a really good team again. And yeah. I'm a little surprised. I think more Vols fans with that question, I think we go with Heupel.
They're going Heupel.
Because it's and it's just so early to think that way. But this is when we're asking the question. But I just think that first season there's just so much hope.
But this is also going back to kind of the origin point of this whole discussion, this is also where Kentucky's unique because most people, like Tennessee, you're probably not thinking, most Tennessee fans are probably not thinking that long about basketball in this question.
Well, that's true.
Like, well, football.
And some of it is just like what you care most about.
Right.
But the question's also, you know, I guess basically like you could get a potentially better coach for the program you care most about.
Sure.
You know? So it's still about the belief in who's in charge. So Vanderbilt. Clark Lee, very early, huge job. Jerry Stackhouse, not as early, big job, big year for him. And then Shea Ralph, very early. I think there's a lot that could happen in a positive way for that program. What are Vanderbilt fans? Who are Vanderbilt fans signing up for long term?
Well, I don't know that there's a single Vanderbilt fan that would pick Stackhouse in this discussion.
Really?
I think there might be some.
I don't think there's one.
I think, yeah, I disagree. Well, maybe they wouldn't pick him, but I think there's a fair amount of the fan base that's still hopeful with him. More probably not, but I think there's some people who, you know, it's not across the board like against Stackhouse or not believing he can do it.
Will in Nashville says Lee stays, Stackhouse leaves.
Okay, so you're going with Lee. Okay.
I might be tempted to go Shea Ralph.
Yeah, like, I mean, again, it's so early and it's.
That's the thing. Like, with it's hard to even judge Clark Lee yet.
Very hard. Very hard to judge Clark Lee yet. Much bigger job. In basketball, you can turn things around in a couple years. And this is part of why, you know, why Stackhouse probably comes in third here, because they haven't had the real breakthrough. I mean, last year was much better, right? They got to the NIT. They had a winning season. They won NCC. Like, it was way better. But now you're losing a great player. We'll see where it goes. Yeah, Lee versus Ralph, that's tough. I'd love to know the results of this, actually. This would be a good poll.
I would.
Joe, what about Michigan State?
Michigan State. Well, I don't
know. Friend of the show.
I don't root for Michigan State. But
yeah, you do. Your son's going there, so you're a fan.
Is that how it is? Is that it is? I am
a
Michigan State
fan.
I am a Michigan State dad.
Contributor Tom Izzo stays.
Just got a contract extension.
Of course he did.
Mel Tucker's been pretty impressive.
He's been pretty good.
By the way, Susie Merchant's been really, really good for a long time. But I don't know. That's an interesting one.
I think it'd be
Mel
Izzo.
Tucker has. I mean, Izzo. Like, it's not. Izzo is already in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Like Naismith. You know, like all that. Like, there's no comparison. And this is almost like the Rick Barnes thing. Remember, you're signing up for someone who isn't necessarily going to be there very long.
I know.
You know. So as far as comparing resumes, it's.
I think Tennessee
not
one's
close.
Really hard.
Yeah.
Which is a testament to the job that they've done building up that athletic department again. Because we talked about this, especially back in baseball season when Vitello had that thing rolling. This is as good a shape as they've been in their athletic department in a long time.
Yeah. But the thing is, like with Heupel, just like with Clark Lee, okay, a nice encouraging first season, much more encouraging, you know, for Tennessee, but also a much easier situation to take over. That offense was immediately like, ooh, it was gasoline. But I don't know. I don't know if he's going to get beyond being a 8-win kind of program. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
But and then when you look at what Kelly Harper's done, she has exceeded expectations. She's been good. That's still a program that has advantages that very few women's basketball programs have. So, like, you should be able to do what she's done. I think she's good. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just you're judging. Well, I mean, look, it's like Cal and Stoops, completely different things that you inherit. I mean, look, Stoops is kind of right about third base. It's just that Calipari has stayed at third base.
He's also been successful in other programs. Okay,
yes.
Move on.
Yes, well,
those have gone well.
I am so
no trouble there.
Yeah.
You know, sounds like Bruce Pearl.
Other than rando people taking SATs for people and whatever else all happened at UMass and Memphis.
Yeah. We'll get back into this discussion coming up at 9:45. Coming up next, we'll hear from Greg Allman from The Athletic, who covers the Bucks. Titans and Bucks at practice this week. That conversation next. This is Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rex Road and Michelle Knezevic here with you on this Tuesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. The Tennessee Titans in action this week against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in practice starting tomorrow and Thursday, and then the game coming up on Saturday as well. And to help us talk more about that, we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and welcome in Greg Allman, who covers the Bucks for The Athletic. Greg, what's going on? How are we doing?
Hey, doing well, guys. Looking forward to getting up there tomorrow for a couple days of joint practices there. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, going to be a good time. Appreciate you taking time to join us this morning. So what are you looking for this week from the Bucs as they take on the Titans, specifically in the practices when the veterans and the starters will likely be on the field for the most part?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a couple of positions where the Bucs have some big decisions to make still. It's a team that has most of their starting lineup probably set, but there are a lot of jobs on the 53. The depth at receiver, the kicking job, the left guard job, these kind of training camp nonsense that people get excited about trying to figure out what the team's going to be. You know, I'm missing out. I mean, the fun last year when the Titans were in Tampa was honestly the interplay between Brady and Vrabel, just his old teammates joking with each other, and it was really a fun dynamic. So it's one of those where it's unfortunate with Brady being out, they won't have the same back and forth.
Yes, no, that's a big loss for all of us, and you know, of course, from the Titans' perspective, it's a big loss for their defense. You know, getting that look too from Tom Brady. But one guy that they might get a decent look from, Julio Jones, Greg. How is Julio looking with the Bucs?
I'll start by saying he's practicing, which
there you go.
Is probably astounding in itself. I can remember this time last year. Obviously, Julio has owned the Bucs for a long time. He's got more yards and catches than any player against the Bucs in history. And I remember last year thinking, like, oh, this is going to be a great test for these young Bucs corners to get Julio Jones. And it's like not only had he not practiced up to that point, he obviously didn't practice in Tampa, and kind of a sign of things to come in terms of what his Titans existence would be. But since he's been here, I mean, they've given him, I think it's three kind of veteran maintenance days, take it easy on him, but he's been healthy. He's looked good, didn't play Saturday against the Dolphins, was kind of held out just because almost anybody worth sticking around for the 53 kind of got the night off Saturday. So I'll be curious to see which of the receivers play. The Bucs have an amazing group of receivers, but a lot of them are dinged up. Mike Evans has a hamstring right now. Russell Gage, who they got from the Falcons, has, I believe, a hamstring as well. Chris Godwin, obviously, is coming off knee surgery. He won't go yet, but he's practicing. So basically the top four or five receivers aren't available, which takes some of the fun, especially with no Brady. But again, their depth, the kind of the receivers 5 through 10 are really battling for the last probably two or three spots on the roster.
So, Greg, with that in mind, when those receivers are healthy, what sort of a role do you think Julio will have with this team?
It'll be interesting to see, and that just by commitment. I mean, Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, I think, are both getting at least $16 million a year. They gave Russell Gage $10 million a year to be the third receiver, so Julio comes in at $6 million, and by that, you'd say he's the fourth. But if he's healthy, it's kind of like Antonio Brown was here 2 years ago, and that if he's healthy, he's a 100-catch receiver. He's a guy that's going to be open, and I mean, to think about Julio's entire career, maybe except for with AJ last year with the Titans, he's been the absolute focal point of every defense he's gone up against. So for him to be able to benefit from secondaries having to account for Evans and Godwin once they're both healthy, I think it's going to be a great matchup for him. I don't know. It's kind of like if you've seen what he's done the last 2 years, you don't really want to work the guy too much. So I think they'll be smart to pick their battles there. He could be a third down guy. He can be a red zone guy. You can use him as a full-time receiver if you want. I just think that increases the odds he's going to get hurt again and you're back in the same boat. So I think he'll be it's funny. Julio's career has been ridiculous yards and catches and not necessarily ridiculous touchdowns. He's only got about 60 touchdowns in his career. I say only 60, but compared to his other numbers, it's not off the charts. And if anything, I think it could be opposite here. I think he might not have the volume of catches and targets and yards, but I think he's a guy they're going to go to when it matters. I think he's another guy they trust, and he'll have maybe the opposite to his stats at the end of the season.
Greg, what's the dynamic now with Todd Bowles as head coach? How have things changed, and how do you think, you know, how do you think that maybe affects Brady this year even?
I don't – it's funny. I can't really imagine a more seamless transition from one coach to another in that, you know, Bowles ran the defense last year, was very much a head coach on that side of the ball. He'll do the same now. He's still kind of the play caller on defense, if you will, very much – drifting to that side in practice, like unapologetically. And part of that is that he trusts Byron Leftwich. I mean, Byron Leftwich was the play caller last year here on offense. So even though Arians isn't the head coach, and you have definitely a different personality to the team with Bowles as the head coach, I don't know schematically that it's changed that much. Arians is still at practice, hanging out, golf carting around the field. So right now we don't see a whole lot different. I'll be curious if they run more. I'll be curious if they're maybe even more aggressive defensively, because I think that's probably Bowles' nature. But right now there aren't like tangible things you point to and say, oh, wow, this would have never happened last year.
Greg Ottman from The Athletic on with us here on Robbie and Rex Road. So, Greg, what are your thoughts on the state of the offensive line for the Bucs now that Ryan Jensen has gone down?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit more in flux than they probably would like it to be. They'll have three new starters on the interior offensive line. So this is a good offensive line. It's an offensive line that gave up two sacks in the NFL last year. But Shaq Mason they brought in from the Patriots. They traded for him, and he's a very capable, if not an upgrade, at right guard. But center's brand new. Robert Hainsey, you know, had 31 snaps on offense as a rookie. Barely played, kind of just mop-up roles at the end of games. They like him. They trust him. But, again, it's a big drop to go from a Pro Bowl center and a guy who had played the most snaps in the NFL over the last 5 years to what's essentially an untested player. Left guard is very much the same. They've probably used four different guys there. They have a draft pick they like, a second-round pick named Luke Getteke, who's only worked with the second team so far, but, again, could end up being the guy that kind of doesn't ever lead. It's like a NASCAR race where you don't lead until the final lap, and he's kind of lurking and ready to go. There's a couple of veterans they've used there, a guy named Aaron Stinney, who had started for them in the Super Bowl, but hasn't necessarily – he could have grabbed the job and made it his own, and he hasn't. So, like I said, there's definitely some uncertainty. Given how much keeping Tom Brady upright and healthy is to their success, that's definitely a concern and something they've got to be careful about.
You know, a guy who I've been – in fact, I think you and I talked about this when he came out, Greg. I've been bullish on – this guy is going to make a difference in the NFL. Local kid, of course, Vanderbilt product, Keyshawn Vaughn. And we started to see some of that last year a little bit. How's he looking in camp, Greg?
Yeah, he had a touchdown Saturday, and he had done that in the preseason over last year. It's tough in that they drafted a kid named Rashad White out of Arizona State in the third round, and Rashad White kind of looks a little bit more like Fournette, like a complete back, a guy that they trust to be able to catch passes and pass block. So it's possible that Keyshawn Vaughn gets overtaken by him. It's like Vaughn didn't have it. They get so vanilla with play calling in the preseason, and it's one of those where, like, I think they ran the ball 12 of 13 first downs. So there weren't great numbers there. Keyshawn Vaughn had 10 carries for 19 carries, which isn't going to wow anybody. But he had a nice catch out of the backfield. Like I said, had a good touchdown. He's probably their third back right now. And for him long-term, I mean, he's in year three now. I think he would have liked to have been the number two. You know, there was probably a world where they didn't re-sign Fournette and he's competing for the starting job. But unfortunately, they did bring Fournette back and paid him a lot, where they're going to use him a lot, and then they drafted somebody his position. So he's, like I said, he's probably marginalized a little by that.
Greg, with everything that happened this offseason with Brady and the retirement and the Bruce Arians stuff, everything that went on with that, what's kind of the vibe around the building with Brady heading into this season, knowing that it could be his last in the league, it could be his last with the Bucs, everything that goes into that? What sort of, I guess, urgency does that create with this team this year?
There's definitely an urgency, and that's a good word to use, I think. Both in that, you know, Brady having retired, having had this kind of weird step back to be with the family, personal reasons, kind of hiatus in camp. I think there's definitely an awareness that unless things radically change, this is probably his last year, if not period, likely here with the Bucs. And I think they've done a good job of bringing in a lot of guys that have played a long time without getting a ring. Julio obviously was really close to one until Tom Brady came and took it from him. Kyle Rudolph has played a decade without a ring. Akeem Hicks has done the same thing. So I think there's – where in last year's team was very much a near duplicate of the Super Bowl team, this year I think they added some hungry guys that don't have a ring hidden in a safety deposit box somewhere and would really like another one. It's a weird thing when Brady is as motivated to get his eight as most people are to get their first. But he is. So it's that thing where it's funny because the Bucs had gone so long here. They go like 13 years without a playoff berth. And now you get to that point where Brady elevates things so much that you can only evaluate the success of a season by how many playoff wins you get. You know, that's something that can't be decided until January, if not February.
Well, you brought up a guy who really intrigues me, Greg, Akeem Hicks, you know, signing the offseason. You throw him with Vita Vea and Golston and Tryon and Barrett. And I've thought all along, you know, the Titans DB is going to get a great look this week, although, as you pointed laid out there, you know, the receivers are banged up. But what a look for this offensive line here in Nashville. How's he look, and what do you think about the, you know, just the potential for that group this season to be great?
He's massive. And I say that, I mean, he and Vita Vea are both legit 345, 350. And that's, they could be bigger for all I know, because it didn't really update us daily on the weights down here. But they're huge. And when they're both together, I mean, the Bucs had a run where they were the number one run defense in the NFL in the 19 and 20. And I think what it does is it really, when those two have to be occupied at the line of scrimmage, it absolutely frees up, like you said, Shaq Barrett and Joe Tryon, and even the linebackers, and it just makes everything around it easier. So I think from a sack standpoint, even if those two aren't getting sacks, they're kind of going to be, it'd be like hockey, and they're going to get like three assists a night just because they're setting other people up to get one-on-one matchups on the outside. I don't know that they'll play them together more than like half the downs, if you will. And they're both probably 50, 60% players by snap count. So I think, you know, third and one, they're both going to be there. Goal line, they're both going to be there. But in nickel, they can, you know, they can put one in and just have one massive run clogger up the middle. But it really changes things. I mean, Ndamukong Suh had been kind of that player, but just from a physical presence, Akeem Hicks. Golston was joking with that the other day. Golston is 6'6 and 317, and he said he feels like a skill position player standing next to those two.
Pretty unbelievable. Greg, great stuff, man. Appreciate you taking time to join us. Looking forward to having you in town, and thanks for making time for us this morning.
Oh, no problem. Thanks, guys. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Greg Allman from The Athletic, our guest here on Robbie and Rex Road. We'll take your thoughts, 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025. We'll look ahead at the practice sessions between the Titans and the Bucks coming up next, and also, could there be a longtime Titan that's maybe in trouble of losing a roster spot here? We'll get to that next as well. This is Robbie and Rex Road, 1025, 1063, The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on 1025, 1063, The Game. You know, school is back in session for a lot of people. If it's not back yet, it's coming soon for others. And there are thousands of children in the middle of Tennessee who are going to be embarrassed on that first day because they don't have a decent pair of shoes to wear. And we want to change that here at 1025 Game. Souls for Music City is joining our cause. Please consider joining us as well with a simple $20 donation. That's all it takes to put a new pair of athletic shoes on the feet of a homeless child in Middle Tennessee. Just text DONATE to 615-737-1025. Once again, that's DONATE to 615-737-1025. Right now, and help us make a difference in the life of a single child. DONATE to 615-737-1025. And thank you very much for your participation and for your kindness as well. Joe, do you think Brett Kern may be in danger of losing a roster spot here with the Titans? He's a guy that's been around for a long time, obviously. Been a very good punter for the Titans. He's 36 years old. Stonehouse is in there. He's been punting the ball well. Was holding some field goals yesterday for Randy Bullock. Didn't go overly well for Randy Bullock yesterday. He was 5 of 8. Do you think that Brett Kern is in any danger of losing his roster spot?
Teresa Walker, shout out to her for a very good observation during the missed field goals yesterday, Stonehouse holding. And according to Teresa, you know, John Robinson closely watching as Stonehouse held for the field goal attempts by Randy Bullock, because obviously that's part of the job. Someone, by the way, real quick on the text line earlier said, why don't receivers do that? I mean, one of the reasons a lot of times specialists get those jobs is because, like in practice and stuff, you have other things for people to do, like their actual jobs at receiver. So specialists, frankly, sit around a fair amount. So if you can, you know, it makes sense to have all of them always working together on those things and having a perfect operation. So that's, it's kind of gone away from the backup QB, which is what it was for a long time. And some people, I think, do that. But anyway, point being, he held. They're looking at him. And I think it's possible. I think right now I'm picking Brett Kern to make the team and have another season with the Titans after taking a pay cut. But if the Titans believe that Stonehouse is so good that they've got a punter for the next long period of time, and I was talking about this with Corey Curtis yesterday, you know, that's something to keep in mind. You don't want to let him go. Someone, if he's this good and he's going to keep showing it in preseason games, someone's going to snatch him up when you expose him on waivers.
Let's go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and welcome in Adam in Portland, who wants to weigh in. Adam, thanks for calling in to Robbie and Rex Road.
Hey, Robbie. Yeah, so that Joe, like, kind of stole it from me there, man. I was going to say, I've never, like, if there's one position I've ever thought of where I'm like, they're good, it's Brent Kern, because we've seen what it looks like when we don't have Brent Kern. You're like, punter, that's not a big deal. It's a huge deal. If you got to do shanking punts or kicking 19-yard punts or, you know, holding the ball too long and getting blocked, that's a problem. And Kern's fantastic, but I didn't even want to look at it because I felt like I was cheating on Kern. I didn't even want to look at another punter, right? But this other one's good, dude. Like, he looks tough, like he would fight somebody for you, like he'd be that punter. He also has a rocket foot, man. So, I agree with Joe, man. I think if he's good enough, I'd say take him.
It's an interesting situation there, and thanks for the call, Adam. You know, you think about it, you don't think about how important punter is until, like, Trevor Daniel walks out there a couple years ago for the Titans against the Colts, and remember what a disaster that was?
Boy.
Good gracious. All of a sudden, punter becomes pretty important.
The most important play in football.
That's right.
Don't forget it.
That's right. So, maybe the Titans have found their future punter here. It's no punt god like Buffalo has found with Matt Areza,
yeah,
who punted an 82-yard punt the other day in the preseason.
Effortlessly.
Like 82 yards.
The guy's not human. You know, with a punt, you know, we make a big deal out of like a 20-plus yard pass. Well, you gain 50 yards of real estate with a punt. So why don't we love the punts more? I don't know.
Well, the real question.
We need more punting awareness.
The real question, as you know, and, you know, hopefully as this competition progresses, you can get to this at some point with Vrabel in his press conference. Do you have the same amount of trust in Brett Kern or in Stonehouse as you do in Brett Kern, where if the situation calls for it, you can run the double reverse with Brett Kern and well, have him take on Devin White one-on-one?
He, you know, Stonehouse looks pretty big. He may not have all of his organs jumbled for him of taking a hit like that, you know? So you might be looking at some fullback dives with him.
Yeah, could be. Versatility is the name of the game.
Vrabel's just licking his chops at the possibilities.
In all seriousness, there were, I think it's fair to say, Brett Kern, not as good of a year last year as we had grown accustomed to seeing. I still think he's going to win the job this year, but it is something to keep your eye on.
I do, too. Now that you just brought that up, like, when he sees Devin White this week, like, does he, like,
flashbacks.
Is there, like, PTSD from this? I mean, like,
just stay away,
run
from
away
me.
To the other end of the field. My gosh.
And look, I mean,
here you go, Brett. Enjoy.
He's probably not going to punt the ball very well this week when he just looks over at the sidelines like, oh, my gosh.
Or
it's Devin White.
Or is he going to ask to go in a one-on-one drill against Devin White and get him back? I don't know.
Maybe so.
We'll trying to win a happens. Job here.
Yeah, for sure. That's going to do it for us today here on Robbie and Rex Road. We'll be back with another award-winning edition tomorrow at 6 a.m. Chase, Willie, and D-Mace up next. This is 102.5, 106.3, The Game.